Something I ask myself in every project is two questions. The first one is, why am I making this? And I want that to be a very honest and personal response. But then the second question would be, why should people care about this body of work? It's so easy to say that my demographic for my work is myself, like, because it makes me happy. If you're putting it out there and there's an audience who's looking at your work, they need to get something out of it too.
Welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. Today we've got I guess I could call you an old friend now, just because you're getting on in years, getting out of school. Anytime I can call someone like in their 20s old is fun. Now that I'm not in my 20s, but met you almost 4 years ago now.
Three? Yeah, three. 2016.
And who your name is probably Joel, or Joel Joel. He goes by probably Joel, and his Instagram handle is
Pika.
Pika.
P-E-E-K-U-H.
All right, there you go. And he's got a very interesting feed. I'd look him up if I were you. But we had you on today because you worked as the behind-the-scenes photographer in a documentary that I'm continuing to work on still, and that was about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And through working with you on that, we realized that you were a very creative person that was very interesting and fun to interact with. So we thought it would be fun to have you on. But to give even more background for those of you who don't know Joel, conceptual artist who explores approaches to storytelling and documentary through a multidisciplinary practice spanning photography, filmmaking, virtual reality, sound design, and interactive installations, undergraduate study in new media at Maine College of Art, and a graduate certificate in documentary studies at Salt Institute, Master of Fine Arts at Maine College of Art. In your spare time, reads dark humor, memoirs, and plays the chromatic harmonica. So, there you go.
You read my website.
What's that?
You read my website.
Tim read your website. I read what Tim wrote down.
Nice.
But, so I was very happy that we made the decision to have you come along as our behind-the-scenes photographer, because you were quiet as a church mouse, but very interesting and engaging to talk to when engaged. And you just did a really great job. And like, we didn't have to ask you to do anything. Like, you knew what you had to do, and you did it, and you did it consistently and well. That was really cool. But just wanted to have you on to talk to you about your very unique approach to seemingly everything you do, from like playing the chromatic harmonica to when I watch your Instagram post, you've always got very interesting pictures, or you're creating music, or like doing all kinds of things. So I think this will be an interesting conversation, long story short. But tell me about how you felt about the 3 weeks we spent in close confines going across the country, and reflecting back on that, how you think about it to start
out.
You're
asking me about 3 weeks from 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really good time. I'm not saying this because I'm on camera.
Joel is not any longer sponsored by Trent Bell Photography, so.
Not anymore, but Poland Springs, maybe?
Poland Springs, maybe, yeah.
Main Home and Design?
Yeah, this is just for us, so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it was an eye-opening experience, and there are a couple things that I did on the road that was, like, on my bucket list.
Oh, yeah?
I checked off.
What
I don't know if you remember them, but visiting Salt Flats.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
That was really cool.
And going to Hardee's.
Hardee's?
Yeah, do you
we
remember
went to
that?
Hardee's?
We went to Hardee's.
I must have blanked out.
I think it was somewhere in Virginia. We're like making our way up. Do you remember that?
We went to Hardee's. I remember going through Virginia, but I don't remember going to Hardee's. That's funny.
Or maybe we went by a Hardee's and I was like, man, I want to go to Hardee's. And we might have ended up going to getting Indian.
Huh.
Do you remember that?
I remember Indian.
I think it was that
somewhere
night.
Somewhere in Virginia.
It's right across the street.
like when I think about that trip across the country mm-hmm. and the visual creativity just involved in every way, shape, and form, mm-hmm. it must be really interesting for someone like yourself with your background coming from a very highly populated, dense area like Hong Kong mm-hmm. To just go across an expansive country like America that's all one country but different states, and then to see the different kind of zones, geography, somewhat different culture.
It was definitely how was humbling.
That? Yeah.
It was really humbling to kind of see the country being so geographically diverse, you know?
Oh, yeah. We went through, like, northwest, down through California, and then mm-hmm. across the desert. I loved the desert from, like, Las Vegas north up to the Salt Flats was probably one of my favorite parts, and then through Wyoming was just...
Yeah, but the bit before that when we had, like, the alternator issues.
Yeah, like...
That was fun.
That was through California and Nevada. That was... Yeah, that was pretty cool. That north and south valley there, mm-hmm. north of Las Vegas both ways, was really cool. I liked mm-hmm. those areas a lot. What was your visual takeaway from that diversity? What still sits with you?
I just think the diversity is cool. Like, yep. you're, say, I think of all the places I've been to, you know, like, mostly big cities, and I've never owned a car.
Yeah.
So I don't really, like, get to drive between cities, mostly just flying, occasionally a train or a bus. Really just to see the landscape slowly change.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really eye-opening for me.
What was visually the most favorite part of the country for you?
Visually? I think the whole northern to southern California, the whole, like, stretch along the coast.
Yeah,
that was... And just seeing, great. Like, I remember my first impression of the California area was that it felt like Maine, but everything was scaled up.
Right. Yeah, that's the Northwest. Mm-hmm. It's like the Northeast, but scaled up. That's a good way of putting it. I've often thought that Maine is very similar to, like, British Vancouver, but just scaled, like, they just took the stretch tool mm-hmm. brought it up. When you're working in that manner, like as a behind-the-scenes photographer approaching mm-hmm. a subject like ours that we were working on, What is your approach and thought process, and what captures your eye when you're shooting?
So I've always kind of went for, like, kind of fly on the wall approach, that I really just wanted to be an observer. I want to be as invisible as possible, but also present at the same time. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think so. Describe it further for me.
So there are times where, like, say when we're trying to fix the van in Las Vegas in yep. some parking lot, that I know that on one hand I'd probably be able to help by, you know, like, maybe get some water, you know, help move stuff around. But at the same time, that's not my role there. Even right. though I'm an extra pair of hands, I am the set of eyes to make sure you remember what happened along
the frustration road. That there was no one there to go get water. It's more important that you walk away at the end of it having documented those moments rather than alleviating those moments.
Yeah, so I think having been through documentary studies and just reading journalism and whatnot, a lot of times people have this, like, moral dilemma that as a photojournalist, do you help someone who is... in need, who is dying, or do you pick up your camera and right. photograph that moment?
What is the take on that?
Y'all are adults. You're not going to die. I'm here to document. So I feel like one thing that's good is throughout most of the trip.
Well, I mean, I was, like, from a documentary school perspective, mm-hmm. like what do they teach you on that as far as, like, in desperate situations?
They don't really teach you that. I mean, like, it's really up to you, like, as a person, which side do you take, and you make your own judgment.
Yeah. Like that that photo in the last 5 years of that, I would want to say, little Syrian boy or girl that washed up on a shore in, I think, in Italy somewhere. I forget. But it was where refugees were coming across, I think the Mediterranean or something, and a child had drowned and washed up. And I remember reading an article about the photographer that captured that image, and it's like he just was just distraught at the moment, but knew that that image would bring so much more attention to the entire situation. And man, it was hard to see, but there's so much value in telling the truth about that situation, you know, and that I think is just so important. Creatively, what moments do you look for, and compositionally, how do you work with that?
So in terms of composition, I think I remember when we had our first meeting interview, that was at Arabica Coffee in Portland. And I was showing you my work, and I think a couple of things that caught your eye were, I did a project in Malaysia where I photographed some apartment complexes, and knowing you're an architectural photographer, maybe it was like kind of a good icebreaker. And back then, and even now, like, some of my photographic work kind of have a little bit of like that Wes Anderson vibe, very like center composed, very orderly. So that was kind of like a personal influence, like of how I make my work and how I like seeing my photographs. So that's more stylistic, but in terms of moments that I look for, again, like to be a fly on the wall. I try to avoid eye contact. I try to avoid being acknowledged. So it's really just catching those in-between moments. Like, I remember there's a photo of, I think, we're all at a parking lot, and Chet, that's his name, right? Chet. Chet was like either about to like lay down in a parking lot, and there was just like this photo where I captured him mid motion where he's like falling.
Oh yeah. We were in a, I think at a rest stop, and Caleb was endlessly working, and we were all waiting for him.
Oh, was that the case?
Yeah, and I think that's the time that we took off to get ahead of him because we were in the slower van, and we took some of his stuff that he had to be able to work. And then when they caught back up to us, he was really upset.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, you got a good photo of it. But I knew I wasn't in the wrong because I had no clue, and I wasn't trying to be, you know, manipulate his working situation. So I just kind of let him vent. And then I was like, I'm sorry I did that. I really didn't intend to do that. And, blah, blah. And the funny part was, as soon as I did that, he's like, that's really good interpersonal skills. You like his manager mind was like, man, if I could hire people like that, that could handle a situation like that, that'd be great. And I was like, it was funny. It just kind of dissipated like in a snap of a finger, which was interesting. But,
that trip built character.
For everybody.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting for me. It helped me. I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, I, for one, learned a lot from all the interviews we did, which, by the way, this trip that we're talking about is a documentary on faith that I'm working on still, and the loss of faith. And we interviewed a lot of psychologists, religious leaders, scientists, you name it. But the real takeaways that I got from that were, for one, just all the interviews we did were really interesting. I learned a lot about the people I was with. I learned, you know, how good of a person Tim is to work with. you know, there were just so many takeaways from there and character building, but I also learned that, like, I was very invested in that, and I realized that I was probably pushing everyone to go as far as I was willing to go. But you have to learn as a manager or someone who's owning the project, right? That you have to understand that you've got far more morale to give to it, to push yourself further. Like, and, you know, Chet kept telling me, like, we need to slow down. We need to take a rest. You know, everyone's getting worn out. And I'm like, I've got 110% energy because this is my baby, and I'm just going to keep going. And it was an interesting learning curve to, like, all right, yeah, that's probably a good idea. We need to let's just take a day off here and not, mm-hmm. you know, but you know, first time for everything. So
who's that guy we interviewed who, when he found out that you hit 20 interviews in like what?
21 days. Oh, I forget who that was, but I remember that being said and they're like, what? But yeah. I mean, we did it and we kind of wanted to kill each other by the end of it, but
I was pretty zen about it.
You had a good time overall.
Like that's kind of the fly on the wall thing. Like I'm not really in the conflict.
You're not in the emotional suit, but you're watching it.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. And you got some great images from it too, which is really cool. Tell me about your journey from Hong Kong to Maine. Like that's kind of being from a perspective of Maine, that's kind mm-hmm. of crazy.
Yeah. I mean, like a lot of people have asked me that question, but I don't really have a good answer. It's all happenstance, you know?
Really?
Yeah. I think I've always wanted to visit the States. And I think when it came down to my last year of high school, I took the SATs. I started looking for colleges. I think I had in mind I was kind of between doing journalism or art. I think those were two things I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given a few cues. My mother said, you know, pick the East Coast.
Why?
I think she just felt like it was more studious, you know, more academic oriented
really?
Side of the country.
Rather than the West Coast. That's funny.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it makes sense. All the Ivy Leagues are in the East Coast.
I guess, yeah.
Maine has three little Ivies, so that's pretty cool.
What are they?
I think
Colby,
it's
Bates?
Colby, Bates.
Bowdoin?
Maybe.
Mini Ivies.
Yeah, that's what they're called apparently. But yeah, no, I just picked a couple of art schools in the East Coast. I think I got accepted to study journalism in somewhere in New York. I don't really remember where it is anymore. But I think 2011, 2012 was around the time that I think it was the Chicago Sun-Times fired all their photojournalists. And then I kind of read that and was like, maybe not journalism for the meanwhile.
Right.
And I applied to a couple of art schools. MassArt rejected me. They looked at my transcript and said, you didn't take enough art classes.
Yeah.
But there's only art as a class, so whatever. And then Maine College of Art accepted me like in a heartbeat. So I just kind of had that as like the baseline.
Right.
I'll just do it, and then I'm here.
Wow, I'm getting a lot of emails right now.
I should probably silence my phone, too.
So, what is it about Maine that grabs you? I mean, visually, culturally, you know, coming from your background mm-hmm. of Hong Kong, Maine's a drastic difference. I've been to Hong Kong, and it's mm-hmm. incredible. Not to say that Maine's not incredible, but they're incredibly different.
Yeah. I think I wanted to be immersed in a different culture, you know? Like, I think I was just reflecting on this a couple days ago. I never really felt like I belonged in Hong Kong. I just never really, like, liked the pop culture there. And I was actually just telling someone that, you know, Cantonese pop music hasn't really, like, changed in the past 20 years. They're all just power ballads.
That's going to be the quote we're going to pull out and put on the thumbnail of this.
Sure. yeah, and I remember growing up, I would spend a lot of time on the internet. I would talk to people. I'd talk to strangers. That's kind of really how I honed my English. I really admired the different cultures out there, so I wanted to be out there.
When I was 12, I went through Japan, Hong Kong, and the Philippines with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an intense, like super active, mm-hmm. just neon powered, intense, like, I mean, I'm talking Tokyo and Hong Kong.
Right.
I get it. But yeah, there is that pop, you know, it's like pop culture turned up.
Was that like late 80s, early 90s?
Oh gosh, yeah, yeah.
I'm not trying to date you.
Don't try to date me. I did buy a really nice Kyosho Altima while I was there, though, RC car.
Mm-hmm.
I remember before we went, my dad told me with the exchange rates, I could save up enough money and like my money would double to be able to get like a really good RC car. So I saved up a bunch and
nice.
Bought one there in Hong Kong and took it to the Philippines where we were going to be for a bit. And my dad and I put it together and it was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the kind of slower pace of life kind of attracted you, in Maine to a degree.
I think the change of pace was really nice. I mean, even, are you familiar with my project and Loneliness and? So it wasn't an ongoing project. I kind of like called it good last year, but then, so, and Loneliness and is a photo series I've been working on between 2015 and 2018, mm-hmm. where I would go out in Portland at night, like the greater Portland area. Wander around and photograph nightscapes.
Well, I love the night stuff that you seem to really gravitate towards those night shots. And I remember in mm-hmm. your portfolio that you originally showed me, I really love like the, cause you get these stark, these, you know, really contrasty colors
mm-hmm.
and a lot of different colors that are singular within the dark negative space.
Yeah.
They're
and
really
I feel
cool.
like that's a very, like it stood out to me because that doesn't exist in Hong Kong. Like, it's something that I kind of realized between doing and Loneliness and.
Thank you. And Tim just brought me coffee. He's the best.
Two sugar cubes?
Two, I don't know. I don't know if it's sugar cubes or packets.
Yeah, so, and Loneliness and really drew me as a photo series because it was really in Portland or somewhere that's not as populated like Hong Kong or a big city
right.
that you'd get these isolated moments
of like a gas station by itself
yeah.
and being a little light pool and then mm-hmm. blackness. Whereas like Hong Kong, Tokyo, everything's this crazy light like that.
Yeah, like...
And I noticed you were in Hong Kong recently.
Yep.
And the one, like, the general memory I have of the images you posted were more so these moments that were mostly all dark and then, like, neon writing singularly mm-hmm. by itself, which are... Yeah, and you're using a Sony still?
Yep, still the same camera.
Yeah, and the files you can get out of those, as you showed us when we were going across the country. I think Chet bought one after that trip as well. But
didn't he sell it after?
Well, yeah, again, to get into the technical, I hate the user interface on
oh,
Sony. They're so like, Canon's just like, it's out there and the user experience is just so much better. But the files you can get out of the Sonys mm-hmm. are, especially with that night stuff that you do, is really, really
yeah,
cool.
And I've been telling people because... I think you know this, before I was a Sony shooter, I had a 5D Mark III.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I use it as a backup camera
right.
throughout the trip, but didn't really get much use out of it. But the way I've been telling people is the Canon is a great camera, and the Sony is a computer with a great sensor on it.
Right.
Like, it's not fun to shoot with. It's kind of sluggish at times because I'm using a four-year-old camera at this point. But... I'm willing to take that hit because I know when I sit in front of my computer and look at the files, I've got work to do. I've got more than I need. So
right.
bottom line is the files that the Sony produces leaves me very little room to blame my equipment.
Right.
So it's kind of a discipline at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
So back to your current art project. Mm-hmm. And these nightscapes that you do. Tell me more about those and why Maine kind of brought these out for you.
I think it was just how differently the cities were illuminated. And even in my master's thesis research, I talked about the Hong Kong photo series as well as the body of work I produce, including a neon sculpture, some sound art, and backlit prints that... Light operates differently in different spaces, right? So I think of, say, Hong Kong and a lot of East Asian metropolitans, that they're kind of like the origin or a visual inspiration for cyberpunk, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you think of the franchises like Ghost in the Shell and Blade Runner. These are all like neon ridden, and you see these kind of like faux Chinese characters and whatnot. And that's kind of like what drew people to Hong Kong at night sometimes, right? You've got, there's this photographer named Greg Girard who did a photo essay called City of Darkness. I think it was around the 80s. He photographed the Kowloon Walled City at night, and they're all like very grim and dark. It looks like a dystopian cluster of people and buildings.
Right.
And then on the other hand, in Maine, I remember speaking to Center for Maine Contemporary Arts, Suzette McAvoy,
mm-hmm.
and she told me that their new art center was kind of designed around the idea of the Maine Light that drew artists to Maine over the years, that like the light is just beautiful for the artist to make landscape paintings. So I kind of put two and two together and kind of really used my opportunity as a photographer, a light painter,
right,
to study light, to see how light operates differently, how it illuminates the cities differently.
Yeah, I think some of the images that I was capturing personally after the trip were very influenced by your work, because I remember when we got back and when we were going across the country thinking, all right, I like this stuff that Joel's doing. Mm-hmm. I want to like experiment in similar manners. And one of the first Instagram posts I got when I got back with the, you know, the van that we bought out there was like a really, really early morning shot. It looked still looked like night, but it was like at the 7-Eleven over here mm-hmm. with the van pulled up to it. And so it was that kind of light pool, you know, and mm-hmm. And I tried to on Instagram use the editing features to make it look like Joel's photos, but you know, it was me. And I think I got the Mark IV like right when we got back from that trip too.
I think you did.
Yeah, because I still had the Mark IIIs because we were filming with those, and I remember Greg Boyd in his interview kept going back and forth, and the Mark IIIs didn't have follow focus for mm-hmm. for the face, and mm-hmm. I remember going back and looking at the footage, and I was just like, ah, he's in and out of focus constantly.
But mm-hmm.
whatever, live and learn. Let's see, I'm going through my interesting questions here that Tim helped me with. He's great with questions.
Why do you get to prepare for questions and I can't like prepare for what to expect?
Oh, it's better. It's more off the cuff that way. It's mostly things I don't want to miss talking about. So you're one of the more interesting creative people that I know.
Oh no, interesting is a loaded word.
Well, you're an odd person. I mean, you're definitely
Yeah,
I mean, and I value that, because good grief, you can, you know, you can run into people that like, yeah, seems like the last person, but you know, you run into Joel and there's this kind of quirky smile and quietness, but there's a lot going on, you know? And it's just kind of like, and Caleb too, like he'll talk about it and he's like, yeah, he's an interesting guy to talk to. I need to.
Y'all are interesting. Y'all are interesting in your own right.
Just weird. But what is creativity to you, and why have you chosen to further yourself in that specific realm, and your output and your way of finding what you're going to do with your life through creativity? Why have you chosen that, and what is it to you?
You know, I just earned my MFA, and they don't teach you how to answer that question still.
Well, I know. I'm asking a personal question here.
Yeah, so I think, like, on creativity, I think first thing I would quote is John Baldessari, conceptual artist. And there's this one interview I think LACMA did, narrated by Tom Waits. And Baldessari gave three pieces of advice for young artists. One, talent is cheap. Two, you must be possessed, which you cannot will.
What's that mean?
That means... you have to be possessed by what you're doing, but you can't will it. Like, you can't force it. Like, it has to come innately within you.
Right. It's kind of like telling people do what you enjoy.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah.
Kind of. But it's in a more kind of like mystified way.
Yep.
Which
yep.
You know, suits his personality. And the third piece of advice is being at the right place at the right time.
Right.
And some people argue that at some point as a creative person or a maker, cultural producer, artist, whatever you want to call it, at some point when you make it kind of your career, it's not just about waiting for inspiration. It becomes a literal discipline that you have to continue on whether you feel like you want to do this or not.
Right.
Because you've kind of committed to it.
Yeah. How do you deal with that?
So far, I haven't really had a huge problem with it. I think...
What would be the problem?
Kind of running out of motivation or ideas or inspiration.
Have you found there to be an ebb and flow in that?
There has been, but not so much that it has deterred me or like stopped me dead in my tracks.
Right.
I think... So one thing I tried to do in my graduate studies is I kind of really went into the program with my photo portfolio, but at the same time, I knew I didn't want to limit myself to photo. It was just one thing I liked doing, and I happened to be pretty decent at it. But I also wanted to explore other realms.
Right.
So I really picked up on a lot of other skills. I went back into SALT. I did my graduate studies in documentary studies. And through there, I have met some really talented radio storytellers and have tremendous respect for people who do podcasts, who do audio work. And then going back into the program, I did some text work, some three-dimensional sculptures. So it's really trying to pick up something that would keep me interested for a while before I lose interest in it. And when I'm kind of like low on that creative juice, I think.
Transfer to another medium?
Yeah. Or the fact that, you know, like I could approach being a maker in two ways. I could either be something that someone's already done, but be so good at it that no one else can match. Or I could just put two things together that no one's done before. And I find myself in the latter more often than I am in the former.
Mm-hmm. Now, to me, it's an interesting subject or situation to look at, the emotional tax of working as a creative.
Mm-hmm.
And just being someone that people call creative, right? There are personality types that in general, the mass of people say, yeah, it's very creative. You know, people have said that to me a lot, but I also find that there's a correlation between those types of people suffering with depression or just being more emotionally volatile, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, there's something about creative people that might not be able to immediately expound upon something with really good recall and being eloquent. Mm-hmm. But they can work through their medium to produce something profound, right? And it seems to me that creative people seem to have more connection, like all of their brain is communicating in a lighter manner, but together at the same time. And they also perceive a lot more at the same time. So smells, visual, feeling, everything, like everything is coming and going very quickly and communicating. And there's an ability to pull from all of these parts and create from that with more effectiveness rather than being able to focus on one thing for an extended amount of time and do that one thing well, like you're saying, switching up before you lose motivation. The same reason probably why I've had as many cars as years I've been married. My wife complains about this, but I say, hey, one wife, many cars.
Tim and I actually talked about it on our way here because we saw your new van.
Yeah, you got a problem. but I think there's a degree at which there's that thing that gives you the ability that's kind of like the aperture being wide open for your brain, right? Mm-hmm. In that you perceive more and process more, and you're able to be creative because of that. But at the same time, as a human, it wears you down in ways, tends you towards introversion and more emotional volatility. Mm-hmm. I think that, to me, that's why those things seem to coincide, if that's the right word. And I think there has to be a lot of awareness of that and maintenance of yourself as a person, especially if you're going to subject yourself to making a living through doing that. Because if you're going to go check in 9 to 5 and do work for someone else that they tell you to do, compared to I'm going to support myself through being continually creative, those are two very different things that can really take a toll on a person, the latter. What's your take and experience on that, and your thoughts for moving into life after university, college, and all that?
So I remember I recently had a conversation with a friend, and she was telling me how she felt like she was letting her younger self down, because she's also a creative person. She's an artist, and she felt like by being in a 9-to-5 job that she wasn't pursuing what she aspired to do as an artist. But for me, I felt like I had the opposite kind of response to that, that as I am older, as I'm more aware of how things work in the world, and as I mature, I've come to realize that sometimes it's about finding the right balance, that maybe I need, so even for my circumstance, because I'm here on a visa, that if I were to be a maker in this country, I would probably need to have a 9-to-5 job, and I wouldn't say give up my spare time, but like my free time outside of my 9-to-5 to pursue what I love doing,
right?
To make stuff. And in
now
some
why
ways,
mm-hmm. How's a visa influence that?
Because if I want to stay in this country to continue to build a career or make stuff, I would need a full-time position.
So you have to work for some, you can't start your own business on
I
a
cannot,
visa here?
Unless
so you
I
have to
five,
be an employee.
Unless I have $500,000 capital.
Yeah.
Or $1 million capital in a high density area to do an investment visa, which
wow.
I think is how Elon Musk came to the United States.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I did not know that. Look at that.
There are a lot of weird visas in this country.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with, I guess you kind of answered that. So you feel yourself losing interest in a medium, and to say inspired, you intentionally move to kind of another medium to move things around that way.
I think I'm more excited in learning a set of skills, or like say speak a new language, as in picking up a different medium. Mm-hmm. Understanding the fundamentals of it and try to relate it with something else and see what I can come up with.
Right. In creating, is there anything that you're coming back to as a foundational thing that you're continually trying to communicate? Like any commonality in all the things you create?
I think there is. I mean, it's always an ongoing journey of trying to figuring that out. There's a part of me that kind of, I think, ever since seeing counseling a couple of years ago, I've been more proactive in kind of looking at my work and reflecting on what does it mean to me. So something I ask myself in every project is two questions. The first one is, why am I making this? And I want that to be a very honest and personal response, that like maybe it's just because I like it, maybe because it makes me happy, and if it is, why does it make me happy? But then the second question would be, why should people care about this body of work? That, like, because bottom line is, it's so easy to say that my demographic for my work is myself, like, because it makes me happy. And I mean, it's valid, but at the same time, realistically speaking, if you're putting it out there and there's an audience who's looking at your work, they need to get something out of it too.
Right.
So I often have to ask myself these two questions to really understand why I'm making what I'm making. And more importantly, why does it matter to someone that this work exists? Because otherwise, like, everyone could just produce things in the world, you know?
Right, we just keep be filled making with stuff, which pretty things that don't relate. See, but I think that there's enough commonality in the hopes, dreams, fears, and all that each one of us have intrinsically as a human, that if we're truly communicating, or if we're exploring and honestly exploring our experience, that what comes out of that will connect with others, just for that single reason. I don't know.
I agree with you, but, like, again, I think I'm looking at it in more realistic terms. Like, you know, who knows, 50 years later, or like when I die, that someone finds value in, oh, apparently this is meaning, but he's dead, so we can't support him anymore. So realistically speaking, I kind of have to convince people that, I mean, this body of work matters, like, it relates to us, so support me while I'm still alive, I guess, you know?
Right. Now, I guess I can't completely say this statement with it being true throughout, but having not gone to school as specifically to produce an artist's vision, I went to school for architecture, which is far more, in my opinion, taking other people's needs and translating them into what is kind of art, but the built environment, and of course. But how have you found an art education to interact with your natural creativity? Like, how do they, what is the general push about and around developing that creativity? How do you teach that, or do you just mentor, foster, inform it? Or
I think that's a good question, because I think about that all the time. And after going through my BFA and subsequently my MFA, I'm very close to coming to this conclusion that going to art school is not about, it's not like going to trade school and then being good at a medium. I think art school, to me, like, what I've gotten out of it so far is understanding the art world, knowing what the game is, how to play the game, and more importantly, I mean, people always like market art school as creative problem solving, but there's truth to that. That a visiting artist at Mecca once said that, like, you know, being artists, yourself included, we are all incredibly talented people at learning new things. We're so good at learning things.
Hmm.
We're so good at adapting. And I think that's what's important.
But how do you see the landscape of people compared to creative people, compared to not create, you know, I don't want to say not creative people, because I view my wife as not creative, but she is when it comes to writing. She's very creative and talented at that. So there's, I think generally everyone's creative in some manner. There's just other people that seem to just not be able to not come out in everything they do. Right?
I think creative, like relating the word creativity with visual arts, can be faulty at times, right? Because, right, like you said, your wife can be creative with words, whatever that means.
Right.
And if we look at art, visual art, as a visual language, it's still a language. Like, right, someone could be creative in anything. That, you know, like, when you're good at something to a certain point, it is, you kind of make it into an art.
Right.
Does it mean it's like capital A fine art that should be in a gallery? Not really, but people could find the beauty in someone's passion. and that's how I view it.
So a friend of mine that trained, studied somewhat as a painter as well, intentionally decided not to become a artist in that sense because he didn't feel he had enough of a voice as an artist. Do you get what he's saying? And do you, not because, well, it was Caleb, you know him. but do you understand that comment and know what your own voice is?
I think I understand that comment, and it's kind of like picking a battle, right? Like, do you want to take on this battle to search for the voice that matters, that people want to listen to, or do you shift your focus to something where, like, maybe, like, shifting from art to architecture is speaking a different language where he finds his voice.
Right.
Like, maybe we can boil everyone down into a checklist of things. I'm 5'7". On a good day, I take photos. And then, you know, everyone has their own list of, like, a checklist of things that defines them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm getting at is knowing your checklist, being content with it, and figuring out what makes you stand out with your checklist. Does that make sense?
I think so. I have a hard time identifying. I have a hard time identifying as an artist because what I do is very commercial, but I like to work in the realm of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a slightly odd mix, I think, of being very driven and enjoy the creative part of figuring out how to make money mm-hmm. at while doing a creative mm-hmm. thing.
I think you're an artist.
I create things.
Got a body of work over there. It's been on Pita Pixel.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to do more of it, but I get sidetracked by these things that are actually paying for things. You know, mm-hmm. I have a very strong drive to not be starving and to be able to feed the children, you know?
And the four cars.
Right. But how do you deal with that? Have you just already decided in your mind, I'm going to find a job that works for me, and then I'm going to pursue my passion as an artist outside of that?
I think so. I mean, I feel like over the years, I've kind of built up a toolbox of skills, mm-hmm. and it's pretty wide, which puts me in a pretty versatile position. So I'm not concerned about my options in my career. And I know that because every piece of tool that I've put in my toolkit is something that I've enjoyed and is marketable. So I don't know. It's tough because I'm still like in the job hunt. I mean, as an artist, I like telling people that being an artist and being unemployed, my best way to frame it is being in between projects.
I'm in between projects.
Yeah, I'm in between projects right now. So without really having a current employment or like a career that I'm working towards, it's kind of hard to answer that question right now.
Right. 10 years from now, what do you think you'll regret having not done enough of or doing too much of?
Regret is a very, like, tricky idea because I try not to have regrets.
Mm-hmm.
What's done is done, and whatever mistakes I've made either contributes to a good story or to who I am today.
Or a great learning experience, which, yeah, is who you are today.
More to put in your memoir or something. Right. But 10 years from now, I think one thing that I have not regret but lamented was not knowing that. So Rochester Institute of Technology offers an undergraduate study called scientific photography. And going through the curriculum, I was just enamored by it. But I was like, maybe in my senior year of my BFA.
Right.
And felt like it's too late. But at the same time, I looked at the curriculum and I felt like I have a basic understanding of maybe a quarter of the syllabus just because of how passionate I was about what I wanted to do.
Now, by scientific photography, do they mean like lab photos? I mean, as far as like photographing kind of mitochondria, like, kind of thing, or the science of photography?
Probably a little bit of both. Yeah. That they kind of like looking at, say, if a camera's a pencil, someone can write with it. Someone can stab someone with it. Someone could draw with it. And as artists, we are trained to use that pencil to draw. And I think that program I would relate to understanding what the pencil is doing, what it could help us with, and learning how to write very technical with it and making charts and whatnot, I guess, is how I would put it. And I really like the idea of knowing the camera as a tool, both as a creative medium, but also as a like measuring tool.
Interesting. Where are you at now that you've finished your MFA? Where are you at now? What are you looking at and hoping to do, you think?
I'm in between projects right now.
In between projects.
Yeah, but I have started a new project. So over the years, I've had this kind of like side hobby of photographing art. That's where the using the pencil as a different method.
Right, far more technical documentary.
Yeah, than like using it to draw.
Right.
Basically, sketching other people's drawings with a pencil.
Which, interestingly, I think architectural photography has a dimension of that. I've always kind of thought that, you know, I'm creatively documenting someone else's work of art.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a degree of that in architectural photography, I think, where I don't want to make my voice too loud.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's going to be about the photograph rather than the subject in the photograph.
It's kind of like a weird space that you and I exist in, because to make your voice most distinct, you have to be invisible, right? And right now I'm starting a project.
While still being consistent.
Yeah. To have an invisible voice that's loud. It's something I'm still grappling and thinking
kind
about.
Kind of a background radiation to a degree.
Oh, God. Yeah. I started a writing project called Notes on Documenting Art.
A writing project?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm writing, like, I don't want to call it a book. I don't want to put that pressure of a book has to be certain inches thick, certain dimensions. I just want it to be a document for now, and if it's big enough to be a booklet, a zine, or maybe an actual book, sure. But trying to keep it realistic, not trying to give it any substance yet, but a writing project where I reflect on what I've learned teaching myself how to document art.
Mm-hmm.
And I intend to include you in it.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
So one part of it, I wanted to talk about my belief that as someone who documents art, I ought to have an art background or know how to speak the language. Because if I look at documenting art as being a translator between, like, say someone's a Spanish-English translator, except in my case, I am a translator for a visual artist to help describe a work of art through images rather than writing, right?
Right.
Then I ought to speak the language, and it makes no sense for a Spanish-English translator to not speak Spanish.
Yeah, yeah.
He said some stuff, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, a behind-the-scenes photographer is exactly that for the documentary project.
Yeah, I think so, and this is where I pull you in. I know that you're an architectural photographer, but you also have a background in architecture, that in some ways I think your work speaks to architects because you speak the language.
Huge. And I would not be doing what I'm doing today and able to pay my bills if I didn't have the architectural background, I don't think. Because I've run into a lot of people that have a photo background that are working some other job with nothing to do with photography. The ability to speak their language, to know the pain that they go through to operate their business and to get anywhere with it, you know, and to be able to speak the same words about the same details, and, you know, that's huge.
And I think, like, that whole, like, translator / interpreter analogy really fits quite well with what I'm working, because there are times where I talk to an artist and they say, the previous photographers have made my work look really flat. I wanted to show translucence. I wanted to pop. I want to have a 3D effect.
Right.
Like, and I'm not in a position to tell them, you can't have 3D in flat photos, right? So then it becomes my responsibility or my role that they've, like, wanted me to work with them to document their art. Then it becomes my responsibility to help emphasize those qualities that they see in their work through the images. And in the same vein, I am helping them describe their work visually, that it gives the same qualities that they've worked towards.
Right. And they presumably wouldn't be coming to you if they didn't like the look of what you've already done
to be in
that position anyways.
And funny enough, I think some of where my projects shine the most were the ones that are kind of like related to what I do. So you know that I have a lot of, I'm really interested and enjoy making photos in the dark at night. And I have had a couple of projects that involve artworks that glow, like including my own personal work,
light emitting
objects, and how to really embrace the shadows has kind of become a niche of mine.
Yeah, there was a piece kind of like that in the lobby of the Colby Art Museum a while ago when we photographed their lobby that was really interesting that they just kind of put off the wall. It was a large, I think it was like a scrolling text piece, actually. Then, you know, didn't have any additional lighting on it or anything else, but it just kind of stood out. It was very minimalist on it. I remember thinking that was interesting, but I don't know what to do with it other than put it in a museum, you know. I don't really have a house big enough to, or a wallet big enough to. what is art to you at its essence?
Art is, I think because of my studies and how I've kind of like, my creative trajectory has happened over the years, that I'm really interested in looking at art also as a way of documenting. Like, it is a documentary no matter what, because if someone's making stuff, it has to be founded on something they know and something they know exists in the world, kind of. You know what I'm saying?
I think so. But I mean, like, at a philosophical level, like, what does art... If you're documenting something, you're still looking at a subject. Is art for you a way of expressing your experience then?
It is. Like, I mean, for me currently, my projects kind of feel like personal diaries or reflections,
right,
observations. But I guess in a more philosophical way, I look at art as evidence of living, like evidence of existence, that like all works of art point to, like, fundamentally, art doesn't really just come out of nowhere. Someone made it, and that art will always have the fundamental definition of someone made this thing,
right.
And that's how I kind of approach everything.
It's kind of, yeah.
I mean, someone built a building, right?
Record of life. That's interesting. Where are you giddy with technical things these days?
Giddy?
Giddy.
What do you mean?
Excited about and like, whoo, have you seen this?
So you had Tim read my website.
I didn't have him do it. He does that on his own. He's good.
Oh, good
like
for
that.
Him.
Oh, he's self-motivated. He's got his headphones on, so he can't hear us.
Oh no, he'll hear us when we edit the video.
Yeah, he'll.
So last semester, I was a TA for a digital audio recording,
mm-hmm.
and I picked up music production.
Ooh, fun yeah. stuff.
Yeah, I have an analog synthesizer at home.
Nice.
What kind of microphone is this?
Shure 58.
I have an SM57.
Mm.
Same capsule.
Yeah.
They sound largely the same, but this is more for vocals, and then yeah. SM57 is more for instruments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got this one like over a decade ago for recording music. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, I already got this one. I'll use it for the podcast, and I'll just get another one. I couldn't find one that didn't have the switch on it when I was looking, so I just got the one with the switch, but
huh.
I didn't like the switch, but whatever.
Is that why I have this microphone?
Subconsciously, maybe. Like, I don't want to talk into the switch. I like it nice and clean.
Sure. Yeah, I started messing around with music again, and one of the things that made me giddy is finding out there's a very specific thing that exists in the world, that someone built a MIDI controller in a form of a harmonica.
Okay.
Isn't that bizarre?
Now, talk me through MIDI controller, because I know MIDI sounds from what minimal, like, little recording experience I have. But are they just synthesized, pre-recorded, computer-generated sounds?
Yeah, with my equally limited understanding, like, think of a MIDI controller as a piano keyboard in the form of a computer keyboard. So it's really just recording the keys, how long you press it, the velocity of which you press it,
mm-hmm.
and then translate that to a set of sounds that are like a package of sounds.
Okay.
It could be a synthesizer. It could be like
Arnold Schwarzenegger saying things.
Probably you could just like map every single syllable,
right,
and make some weird sounds. But so that's kind of the idea of a MIDI controller, to be able to input.
So they kind of mapped that into the workings of a harmonica, and by yeah. interacting with the harmonica, it makes these other sounds.
Yeah, and you like blow into the harmonica, you draw notes in the harmonica, press right. buttons, and it works like a keyboard.
Wait, keyboard? I thought it was a harmonica.
Yeah, but they all make sounds, right?
Okay. But they all, like the keys of the keyboard?
It would be as if you're playing the keyboard, but you're playing a harmonica. Say, like, you're playing a song. You can play it with, like, the keyboard. Do, re, mi, fa, so.
Yeah.
Or you can play in a harmonica, like, blow, draw, move, blow, draw, move, blow.
Yeah, okay.
Same idea, but someone made a MIDI controller in a form of a harmonica.
And so instead of getting harmonica sounds, you can get programmable MIDI mm-hmm. stuff, and you generate it through blowing through the harmonica.
Yeah, like imagine, you know, Daft Punk.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine like Daft Punk playing like a live show, but instead of a keyboard, they're all just playing harmonica. There's a cable into a big
computer. Well,
it'd
be hard though, because they have the masks.
Oh, that's a good point.
Right?
Well, some electronic artist who doesn't have a mask, which is hard to find nowadays for some reason.
Right? Right?
Everyone wants a mask.
Dead Mao and, yeah.
Even Buckethead has a mask.
Right. He's old school though, isn't he? I mean.
He was recently in Portland. Do you know that?
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. He's British or something, isn't he?
I don't know, but if you go on his Wikipedia page, he cranks out hundreds of albums a year.
What?
Yeah. Bizarre things you can find in the internet.
Yeah, I know many people who get sucked into those, like, you know, like, oh, I'm gonna, like, I'll occasionally get sucked into boxing videos for some reason.
Boxing?
No interest in boxing, but like.
Like boxing the sport.
Yeah.
Not unboxing.
No.
I got into a brief period of like, you know, watching people. Yeah.
Unboxing videos. See, the thing with me with it seems like kittens and unboxing videos are big on the internet, and I just don't, I don't get it in that, like.
Yeah, but you're a dog person.
No, I like kitten videos. Don't get me wrong. I'm talking mm-hmm. more of the unboxing. I mean, kittens are cute, but they are nest parasites, essentially. Dogs aren't that much different, but still, like, there's weird things with cats that if you look at it from a very biological perspective and how parasites work, Like,
I'm scared now.
Cats are like very much so, and they carry a lot of weird parasites and stuff, and they think they do weird things to people too. I mean, did you ever read the National Geographic article on parasites?
No.
Like, I think it was called Animal Zombies, and like wasps that like will land on cockroaches, inject their stinger into the cockroach's brain, and be able to remote control them and ride them into their nest so their young can feed on them. I mean, crazy stuff, like worms and crickets that put out this thing in the cricket so it wants to get into water and drown, and then the worm can come out and go to its next stage of development in the water. A parasite that can only develop in the stomach of a cat. So it starts out in a mouse, but then it releases something in the mouse that makes the mouse attracted to cat urine. So then it will go where cats are and get eaten, and then the parasite can develop in the cat's stomach after that. I mean, all these really weird things, and cats kind of play into that in a weird way. So I think there might be something to cat people.
Should we rename the podcast to Parasites and Cats?
Yeah, Parasites and Cats, and whatever the Cantonese pop, what was it?
Oh, boy. Cantonese pop music?
Yeah.
Power ballads for only power ballads. 2 decades? Yeah.
Right. So in your finding, let's say you find your perfect 9-to-5 job, what are you going to be focusing on creatively starting out, you think? What do you, if you could paint the perfect picture to what you'd like to be doing?
So I've been thinking about that lately. I think my long-term goal is to have a studio and my own personal practice specializing in documenting art.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to afford enough time to be teaching at a college level.
Cool. Now, why the draw to teaching?
I think it's partially because of my graduate studies. Like, with an MFA, I earn a terminal degree in fine art, and I could teach at a college level.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that just kind of got me thinking, like, well, I have this degree now. Like, I pretty much have opened the doors to... It's not necessarily, like, a very high-paid job, but it's not a bad job either. Right.
Well, it's a job that you'd continually be in and teaching and more deeply embedding the philosophies of art and the process of art and creation mm-hmm. into yourself and with others mm-hmm. that could only benefit, I would think, your production outside of that.
Yeah, and I think because of my trajectory that I'm not really given the freedom to be a full-time creative artist,
yep.
that it was never my intention to be one. So I started thinking about how do I contribute to the arts without being an artist, like to make stuff, put in a gallery, occasionally be in a museum. I don't know. I started thinking about what I do, why I like doing them, and how others could benefit. And I've kind of like come to the conclusion that as much as I like having creative practice, as much as I like making stuff, I'm more interested in the peripherals of being an artist.
How, like, what are the peripherals of being an artist to you?
I think I'm interested in teaching young artists things outside of making stuff.
Okay.
Like
how to think about it?
I guess. I mean, I'm trying to keep it pretty open just because I don't want to limit myself into a very specific thing, and yep. that's all I do. But one thing I could kind of relate to it is my role as a art documentarian is to promote the idea that when you're done with that final brushstroke on a painting, when you're done printing your work, that's not the end of it. You also need to know how to package it nicely and archive it.
Mm-hmm.
Say, have it professionally photographed. Know how to write about your work, package it well so when you submit it to shows or to a different organizer who may want to see or acquire your work, they understand what your work is and they could also convey that message effectively to others. And I really want to promote that
And so that realm of the art community to you is very interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's probably also just because I was surrounded by artists that I got into what I do today, mm-hmm. documenting art. But also, like, one of the things that I find really valuable was that by affording myself to document art, I have a very intimate and unique way to interface with a work of art, to really, like, have a pillow talk with a work of art that I really spend a lot of time getting to know something in order to know how to translate it to someone or document it. Does it make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I'm constantly thinking of this in the realm of, in this conversation, I keep imagining, I think a couple times I've documented just paintings, and it's like, just make sure everything's even, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, and do it that way, unless it's a very textured piece of art, and then you need mm-hmm. to create some shadows and stuff. But it goes far beyond that, I would assume, then, that you know, documenting a sculptural piece or a neon piece or whatever is going to, yeah, it's just a much bigger world than I would have previously thought.
Yeah. And I think some point in my career, I kind of thought to myself, I like documenting art because it's a little bit of everything, mm-hmm. but in a very specific theme, right?
Right.
Like, documenting a gallery opening or performance piece is like event photography. You're like dealing with people moving around. It's like a one chance kind of thing. Whereas documenting a smaller three-dimensional objects feels like, you know, product photography. You've got your, like, your sweep, your lights, and then going into something that's like flat work. Like, say if there's a painting in a gallery or a museum, that's like copy work. So it kind of gives you a taste of everything you could do as a commercial photographer, but still be adhered to your practice, which was incredibly rewarding for me. Because at the end of the day, that also feeds back to my understanding of art.
Right. Now, where do you think and value the balancing of the technical and the creative, right? Because with photographers, you'll run into these people that are just all about the technical, and they're just into the latest gear, and they're just obsessed with it, far more so than the creation of images that move people, it seems. You know, they'll just be gearheads to the nth degree, and then there'll be people that are just, they could care less about all that stuff, and it's all about whatever emotive you can create at the end of the day, right? Mm-hmm. For you, where's that balance in your interest lie?
Oddly enough, I think I'm kind of an even split between the two.
I would say that too.
Yeah, like, as much as I enjoy making art through making images, I'm also so invested in the technical aspects of it. Nowadays, like, so I've had a camera with me since I was 8.
Hmm.
Yeah. And nowadays, there's not really much gear lust, if you will. Granted, I have acquired a series of tools that I feel like are capable.
Right.
And they're by no means like
amateur. What do you
think
of that new Fuji medium format? It's only like 10 grand. Have you seen that?
I've looked into those. Unfortunately, knowing my work, you know how wide my photos get?
Yeah.
Because of how square the sensor is, it doesn't really like make much sense for me to have one as a camera with me.
Right.
If anything, I do a lot of stitching panoramas.
In our work too, mm-hmm. we basically would make the same image. We just stitch using the tilt shift lenses. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's worth it to me to, you know, sell all my gear and get that when I could have the option of doing square or, like you're saying, very panoramic, because mm-hmm. we do that a lot, and I really like that versatility. But anyways, the intersection of technical and creative, it seems like with you, you're very capable and interested in the technical, but you can obviously show on the other side, you create these very interesting emotive images that maybe come through that very technically interested filter. I don't know.
I think they feed into each other, that because of how invested, and I will have to put a disclaimer, like, I'm very technically invested in digital photography because, like, I don't really do much film photography. I have complete respect for people who do it and do it really well. It doesn't intrigue me as much as digital because it kind of feels more mathematical. It's really exciting to think of the idea that, you know, at the end of the day, your JPEG has what? Red, green, blue channels. You have 256 values in each of them. You can really quantify, like, the luminosity of things. So that really intrigues me versus the film counterpart. And I think, so one thing I want to write about in Notes on Documenting Art is to include this glossary of terms that artists use to describe their work and how I would interpret it in photography. And I feel like,
interesting,
by having my technical proficiency, I am able to emulate certain qualities that translate to emotions to people. So it's really about breaking down the language and then reconstructing it backwards.
Right.
To get the same thing.
Almost a scientific process to then inform your process, right? And I often thought about that in architecture school when they talk about the shapes of different spaces or exteriors and how they would, you know, generally make people feel. It seems like they'd have more scientific research on that, where, like, this percentage of the population when faced with an oval space rather than, or, you know, feels this way. And, like, the experience of the arts would be more objectively studied, but it is such a subjective realm. Maybe the people that pull the strings in that art realm are kind of offended by the idea of objectifying any of it.
I think it's, there are like two camps of it. There are like two different means to an end. To think of, like, say, I don't really have specific examples, but just kind of imagine artist A, who doesn't really know much about the technicals of stuff. Like, they probably say, oh, I don't care, I just make the stuff. And they're really good at making the stuff.
Right.
And their work is compelling, and people could, through, you know, critical theory, unpack why the work is powerful. And then on the other hand, you have artist B, who is so technically proficient, they could give the illusion or impression of anything. Even though it's not like, I don't want to say it's not from the heart, but it's not where it comes from.
I see what you're saying there. And it, to me, Amber and I, my wife, Amber and I were just in London and we went through the National Gallery, National Portrait Gallery or National Gallery, whichever. And it was really interesting to look at the different time periods of art. And there was one that I think it was around the late 1400s where some duke or other was getting his horse painted. And something went wrong in the process. Like, they cut the funding for finishing the thing or something. And it's a big piece. But it stopped somewhere, and it was on just this very kind of yellow negative space with the horse rearing up in the middle of it. And it's the first piece in that era or, you know, time that it was like, that I've seen, that it almost looked like modern art. I mean, very much so, that it was just this horse that you could barely see, kind of a little bit of shadow off its 2 feet that were still on the ground, connecting it to the negative yellow space. But it was painted with all this, you know, very, very realistic still from that, you know, period realism, you know? And to me, after going through all these other paintings of all these Greek stories of these weird ancestral moral situations, and, you know, they were all visual recreations of all these either rich families just getting themselves painted or artists reflecting back on religious or philosophical or narrative stories from Greek mythology and everything. it was the first one that was just kind of like, it was a visual expression that, or felt like it felt more like modern art. And it was really, to mm-hmm. me, it was like, wow, this is really interesting and very calming at the same time, but very also, it's just a huge, beautiful, muscular horse, but
the background was incomplete kind of thing.
Yeah, but it was really nice. I mean,
I think that goes back to what I was saying about art being an evidence, right? Like, of existence, that it drew you to it because it stood out to you, that it told a story of an artist was commissioned to make a painting of a horse but couldn't finish it. And it's like that evidence of circumstances that stood out to you. I mean, like, granted, right. we could also argue about the incompleteness being against this kind of Western hemisphere of making art, because we know that, like, the Eastern hemisphere of art, there's this idea called lao ba in Cantonese, mm-hmm. Which is leaving things white. Like, you see watercolor paintings. You don't prime a piece of, like, paper. You just leave it as white the way right. it is. So this idea of the negative space being untouched is not seen in the Western hemisphere of art making, at least not in that time period. So right. that kind of, like, drawing of lines and creating this weird deviation from what we know of as history creates an impression. At least that's how I would interpret right. your experience with it.
Yeah, it was interesting to see the very literal realism mm-hmm. and the full picture, you know, being painted mm-hmm. that referenced something beyond that, and then going kind of more, you know, very much more minimalist, but saying less literally by mm-hmm. creating more minimalism within the visual space of creativity. It's interesting, like, how that within our history of us as humans is this one thing, and it translates into more modern art now that's this extreme minimalism and everything else, and art theory and in history to me is very interesting, but at the same time, I just 100% don't get it mm-hmm. at the same time, you know? But I do find that really good art seems to come from people who are questioning and struggling mm-hmm. at the same time.
Do you think it because it shows emotions or shows, like, the human side of things?
I think a lot of that observation comes from my own background of being involved with a culture from my religious upbringing that had all the answers. Mm-hmm. So a true exploration into art was kind of needless. And so the arts within that realm seemed kind of impotent. Mm-hmm. And just kind of meh. Like, and it just seems like that this more emotive, beautiful creation came from a more honest place of the reality of the struggle of being human, whereas the more certain cultures don't really produce as much mm-hmm. like that. It's more so they produce, we know everything already, and so we manufacture this over and over, as in we have these morals and these ways of living that we do this and we stay within that. It's a lot cleaner and it just, like, cookie cutter kind of thing. I could, you know, this is just my own experience and mm-hmm. I could be totally wrong, but that's what I felt. And when I exist more in a space of admitting, I don't know, I have been wrong, here's the times I was wrong, sorry for that, and here's the things I don't know. Mm-hmm. To me, the honest intersection of all those situations produces something that's more engaging. Communicating and sharing your fears and your failures in a brave way. So sharing fear, but in a courageous way. Being honest and open about it, I think creates art, creates exploration that is more emotive, more moving, and has more value to it, in my opinion.
I think good art should raise questions.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, like, art that doesn't ask questions, that just kind of gives you a statement, makes you feel good, but it kind of ends there, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In the same way, there's philosophies in advertising, I guess, that are kind of like confuse and explain within the, you know, so with a photograph, they'll use something to completely confuse you. And you see it and it's almost comically weird, but then with the text, they'll explain it. And then it's like, oh, and then you give them the logo and they're like, thanks, logo.
Have you ever experienced an architecture that raises questions? Like, not just like structurally. You know what I'm saying?
But how so, like, just experientially? Yeah. Like the movement through it and everything? I've never been to that. What is it, the Remington House or something, where whoever, someone made the repeating rifle and killed billions of people or something, and the heir to the fortune, like, was tortured by it, or, and they made her like a super weird house that had like hallways that got smaller and all this weird stuff. I don't know that I've ever experienced anything like that. I haven't been to the Getty Museum in, drawing a blank, I think it's Bilbao, I don't know, in Spain. You know, that's a very, you know, far different experience than our normal, like, 90 degree walls and stuff. In all the architecture I've experienced, we went to, I think it was a chair museum in Germany somewhere that had a lot of circular shapes to it and was very confusing. The Modern Art Museum in Boston, down in the Seaport District, I think. That was, to me, a slightly confusing building to interact with. And I didn't like the experience of interacting with it, honestly, but I loved the visuals of it. But there was something about moving through the space in looking at the art that was like, it didn't let the part of my brain that just wants to move through a space to keep seeing art relax. It had to stay engaged. And it was just kind of annoying. But every space of that building, to me, it was kind of like bad architectural photography. So the experience, this is interesting. The experience of that building, I love that building, and I've got images that I really like of it, and I love every space of that building, but it seemed like bad architectural photography in that it was trying to dominate the experience of being there rather than being a passive means of showing the art. Now, if you contrast that with, I think, Louis Kahn's building somewhere in Texas that's a museum that... Boy, if anyone listens to this, I'm a pathetic excuse for knowing my architecture and architects. But it's a much more, as far as the experience of moving through it, as I know it, it's a more, not regimented, but obvious layout of how to move through it. And in the same way I've experienced, well, the equation is that, or the expression is that, bad architectural photography to me has too much to say about the photograph rather than accentuating just the architecture. To me, the museum there in Boston, in my experience of it, was I was experiencing the building more than the art in it. And so it was taken away from the art, right? And in the same way that I had to keep my mind active just for making my way through the building in that, I'm finding now that I've stepped back and I'm re-examining and intellectualizing my worldview, losing my faith, basically. It engages parts of me to process everything going on and doesn't allow me to be present as much because I'm constantly processing what everything means and why everything is and why should, you know. It's like I should have been able to put all that stuff, not behind me, but I should have been able to get a hold of all that stuff through my impressionable years and then use that map to process the rest of my life, not have to dig it back up and retool, recalculate everything to make it through. Now, maybe that's just a natural maturation process and it's what I should be going through. You know, fine, but it is exhausting and it's an emotional toll. And it's interesting to me that it relates to that process of going through that museum. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting aha moment there.
Nice.
For me. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
That's probably a good place to end. I don't know. You have anything that you wanted to ask me? I don't know.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now, but
no.
I'm sure I'll have questions to ask you, like whether it's now, later.
Later. We'll have to do this again.
Sure.
Maybe make it an annual thing to see where you're at with art and documentary and visas and everything else. So,
do I have to like do an evaluation of you as well?
Oh yes, there'll be an exit exam on your way out, an evaluation form. But anyways, thanks for coming down, and thanks to Tim for bringing you down and arranging this. It's good to see you again. Good to catch up with you.
Likewise.
And again, anyone who's interested in seeing all of Joel's stuff, you can follow him at Pika on Instagram, and you can spell that. But yeah, he's got some really great night photography stuff that I try and emulate sometimes. So check it out. It's eclectic and very cool. So
we can talk shop in another episode.
Let's talk shop again in another episode. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, thanks for coming down, and thanks for watching. And please subscribe and like and share and all that. Later.